You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As racial tensions escalated across the United States, many newscasters and members of the public talk as if they came out of nowhere. This makes it all the more important to look into their root causes. Mark Lamont Hill, distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College, examines how African Americans are often the targets of dwindling job markets, the privatization of public resources, overly hostile policing, imbalanced legal systems, and mass incarceration. In Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It's published by Atria Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Mark Lamont Hill to our show today. Hello.
I'm excited to be here. Forgive my voice. I've been fighting a bit of a challenge. So if you hear some wheezing, it's not my Trump impersonation. It's me trying to give you some depth here.
Why did you name the book Nobody?
You know, I was in Ferguson, and I got there on August 10th, 2014, the day after Mike Brown had been killed. And you could still smell death in the air. There was a town that was shocked, unsettled by Mike Brown's death at the hands of Darren Wilson. You could see blood in the ground. You could hear children still talking about what it meant to watch him lay on the ground for 4.5 hours unprotected, unattended to. Adults talked about what it meant to see this kid who they raised laying out there. No medical attention. A sheet barely fit over his body, and that came hours later. No medical attention, no police officers. And one of the residents turned to me and said they left him out there like he ain't belong to nobody. Like he ain't belong to nobody. And that sense of nobodiness lingered with me. It stuck with me, and it spoke to a deeper issue about the disposability of America's vulnerable.
Can you talk a little bit about the photo of a little boy on the front cover of the book?
Ah, yes, that's Nigel. He actually popped up a few months after Mike Brown's death. We were leading I was part of a march in Ferguson a couple of months after the death, calling for justice, calling for an indictment. And Nigel was this little boy who was in part of the rally, and he ran up in front of everybody else, and he was literally standing in the street waiting for us. And for me, I found that to be interesting and compelling. The image itself is compelling because it's a little kid standing in the street, and it's symbolic of multiple things. One, he's waiting for the rest of us, right? Young people are leading the march.
Mm-hmm. Young people are leading. Big crowd behind
him. Big crowd behind him, and it's a crowd of people who are fighting for justice. But there's a way in which the Ferguson activism and the activism in Baltimore and the activism in New York and other places was led by young people. But there's another piece there, and that is that you also see police lights coming toward them. And there's a sense of vulnerability that young people in this country, particularly black and brown people, feel and are prone to because of law enforcement. And so in many ways, Nigel's leading the march, but he's also the most likely to be on the wrong end of state violence.
Last week, we talked about a documentary called Cease to Resist, which is about the militarization of police departments across the country. And there were tanks in Ferguson.
There were. We saw tanks. We were tear gassed. I saw surveillance drones. I saw, you know, grenade launchers. It's fascinating to see a town that does not have even dashboard cameras to capture what happens between Darren Wilson and Mike Brown be able to have such a militarized presence the moment something happens differently. And it's not just Ferguson, which is a small town. There are only 20,000 people in Ferguson.
But it's really part of the greater St. Louis area.
Absolutely. But it's also part of a national project that begins with the war on drugs to militarize police departments. So police departments that have never had a murder or have had one murder every 10 years have excessive weapons. You know, towns that have never needed a SWAT team were given SWAT equipment. You know, the amount of paperwork that was needed to use a grenade in 1960 was stunning. The amount of paperwork it was needed to use to get a SWAT team was stunning. And now in 2016, it's very easy. And that's how you see not just the militarization of police, but the shooting of unarmed citizens, oftentimes incorrectly, like in the case of Katherine Johnston in Atlanta.
Didn't you run into a burning building in Ferguson?
I ran into several burning buildings in Ferguson. I think one of the most fascinating things about Ferguson was after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson in November, I was there on South Florissant when the announcement was made, and the town went nuts. People were outraged. People were hurt. a police car got flipped over. There was outrage, and they tear gassed us very quickly once again. But what was interesting is South Florissant is where police were present. It's where bars were. It's where middle class and white businesses were. South Florissant got under control very, very quickly. Very, very quickly. I went over to West Florissant, which is, you know, where the Quick Trip was. This is where the liquor store was that Mike Brown pushed the store owner and stole the cigarillos out of. There was not one police officer there. There was not one National Guardsman there. There was nothing there, and the town went on fire. I went into the burning building, which is, you know, as you know, as a journalist, that's our job, right? People are running one way, we're running the other.
I don't know. I never run into burning buildings.
You've made much better life choices than me, clearly.
I sit in the studio. Yeah,
that's a much better job, believe me. You got the long end of the stick here. But I ran in to see what was going on, and I watched people setting things ablaze. I watched people doing things, and I refuse, both then and now, to see that as a riot. I think it's a much more complicated and nuanced set of circumstances. It was a social rebellion. But I thought it was interesting that the police were there to protect their property and the property of white middle-class homeowners and not to protect the vulnerable.
And you write that many of the casualties in your book were not killed because they were black, but because they're from a disposable class.
Yes, you know, of which black is a primary indicator. So we never want to ignore the role of race. Race is a central organizing principle of American inequality. It's you know, people think of racism as one of the original sins of this nation, if not the original sin, slavery specifically. I would argue that it's capitalism and that it's an obsession with markets. But either way, this mix of racism, this mix of a kind of neoliberal ideology where the market becomes the ultimate adjudicator of good and bad, the ultimate court of appeal, the ultimate decider of right and wrong, our obsession with class arrogance, our connection to homophobia, our refusal to see trans bodies as legitimate, all of these sensibilities, all of these ideologies kind of conspire against the vulnerable. So it's not just the black person who's vulnerable in public space. It's also the trans woman. It's also the poor white worker who's vulnerable, not just to kind of the front page forms of state violence, but also the kind of state violence we see in a place like Flint.
But aren't trans people and, in fact, gays also vulnerable within the black community? I've been in churches where the preacher talked about the terrible sissies and bulldaggers, and let's get rid of them out of our community.
Absolutely. I hope you were just visiting that church and not attending for regular as a parishioner. But
well, I have another career as a gospel DJ from the old days, so I was
so you
there
have
for
choice,
a program.
Right. There you go. No, I mean, that kind of theology, which, by the way, is not exclusive to African-American churches. I mean, white evangelical churches preach the same nonsense. It's part of how a Trump makes it into office, is because there's a certain set of xenophobic and racist and homophobic sensibilities that can be kind of advanced and mainstreamed through a Trump presidency, or at least a candidacy. Well, knock on wood that it's not a presidency, at least I will. But when you talk about vulnerability within the black community, absolutely. That's why it's important, as Kimberly Crenshaw has talked about for years, this idea of intersectionality, this idea of multiple jeopardies. On the one hand, you are black. On another hand, you might be gendered woman. On another hand, you might be trans. You might be cisgendered, you know. But all of these things are complex. So somebody like Maya Hall is black trans woman who's poor. So, yeah, that was why she gets shot by NSA officials. Not that they said, hey, we're going to go shoot a poor black trans woman, but that those circumstances shape how she's read and how her death is received.
My guest is Mark Lamont Hill. His latest book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond, published by Atria Books. Can you talk about the Pruitt-Igoe apartments and the role they played in shaping the history of Ferguson? Am I remembering correctly, there was all this footage of these projects that suddenly they put explosives on the bottom of the buildings and they just came down very dramatically.
Oh, they absolutely did. And that's one of the challenges of Pruitt-Igoe, is that one, it went up, it went down almost as quickly as it went up. You know, it's built in 1954. And by the 70s, it's gone.
It was, and people were talking about getting rid of projects all over the country.
Right. I mean, one of the things we have to think about is how social, or rather how housing was seen as a project of social engineering and of social equality, right? That if we could get people access to housing, we would have a different kind of circumstance. The Pruitt building was designed to be after for African Americans. The IGO building was supposed to be for white Americans. They would coexist. They'd have skip stop elevators. You know, stop on the first floor, the fourth floor, the eighth floor, and then people would walk the other three floors, which would allow them to see people and build community. Instead, it didn't. Instead, it created pockets of violence. You know, you walk off the first floor and someone's waiting for you on the third floor. White people never fully embraced the projects, and they didn't really occupy IGO in the way that we would have expected. At the same time, people were incentivized to move out of St. Louis, particularly white Americans. So all these factors, you know, kind of complicated things. Things didn't get fixed. Women were harassed. Men were kind of chased out of the building. And many of the people, when the Pruitt-Igoe housing project failed, and it was a failed liberal and conservative project, when it failed, a lot of residents went where? They went to Ferguson, a suburb.
And Ferguson wound up having its population, its African-American population, grow from 25% to 67% between the 1990s and the 2010s.
Which is stunning.
Was that reflected at all in the makeup of the racial makeup of elected officials and the local police force?
We would hope. It looked much more like South Africa than South Missouri. You know, it was, you know, the police force was almost entirely white. The city council was almost entirely white. Police chief was white. The demographic shifts did not shift the power. It's also important to note that even when there's a demographic shift in elected officials, like in Baltimore, where everybody's black, right? Marilyn Mosby, you know, we can go down the list from the prosecutor to the mayor, et cetera. It doesn't necessarily change how justice is carried out. But in Ferguson, I think one of the challenges was you had a black population, which was being governed by white officials and policed by white officers. But you also had a town business, which was largely exploitative. There are 20,000 people in Ferguson, and this number is going to shock you. There were 20,000 people in Ferguson, and 16,000 of them have some form of warrant. I mean, can you imagine 20,000 people in a town and 16,000 of them have some form of warrant?
That was usually because of traffic stops.
Absolutely. And then the kind of compounding of the traffic stop with people not being able to afford to pay it. And this becomes essentially a town business after many other town businesses left, like Emerson Electric.
Has that all changed after the Department of Justice pointed all of that out, did a study?
Some has changed. There are more black officers. Control over the police has expanded. There are fewer stops, fewer tickets, fewer warrants. Tax revenue, municipal court revenue has dropped from, I think, $3.5 million to about $400,000 or $500,000 last year. Of course, the problem is now there's no money. Right? So when you have a town business on exploiting people, you pay one way, you pay the other way.
How much of that was just a racial policy, and how much of that was an extension of the broken windows theory?
It's both and. I can't imagine that a town filled with white people would be stopped for jaywalking the way Mike Brown was. That seems unimaginable to me. In the same way that I can't imagine a town filled with poor white people would have been poisoned for a year and a half with lead-filled water like Flint was. But broken windows policing absolutely plays a big part in it, because it's not racially targeted as such as much as it is an ideology about how policing should happen. And the problem is broken windows theory as originally conceived has never been the kind of policing that we saw here in New York. When David Dinkins begins this project, you know, bringing people into the mix, bringing Bratton into the mix, first from MTA, then into the full police force, when Giuliani kind of takes the baton and runs with it fully, what we saw was not what was initially intended by broken windows policing, which included community-based resolutions of things, which included patrol people walking the beat instead of driving through patrol cars. It involved an assessment of what was a crime and what was a crime. You know, like, okay, you can't sit on the sit on the steps, but you can't fall out on the steps. You can sit straight up. Yeah, you can drink your liquor, but put a brown bag on it, right? These were community decisions. Yeah, we know the old man has a gun under his pillow, but you know, he's not bothering anybody, right? These kids are tagging graffiti. We're not going to lock them up. We're going to just take them home, right? If they cut school and they're tagging, we'll send them home. Their mom will give them a spanking or whatever. I'm not condoning spanking. I'm just saying. And that's the end of the day, right? It was a community kind of based premise, which was largely informed by the officer's relationship to the community. This was about community building. This was about, you know, broken windows has become something different. It's become, we're going to find disorder and we are going to stop it in order to reduce crime.
It was pointed out that African American residents wanted crime to be eliminated in their neighborhood.
Of course.
And so they welcomed the cops. And,
absolutely.
And right now we have the sense that there's a, this total distrust of the police in minority communities in this country. And we're going to take a little break and come back to that and come back to the other side's arguments in
absolutely.
This discussion.
I love those.
My guest is Mark Lamont Hill, Nobody. Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond is his book published by Atria Books. Stay with us for more. We are back with Mark Lamont Hill. His book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond is published by Atria Books. Didn't you work at Fox for a while as a commentator?
Yeah, as I like to say, I was on the visiting team, though, you know.
And you also, when CNN broadcast the death of Walter Scott, Harry Houck argued that he would have been alive today if he'd stayed in the car like the officer had told him. Isn't that sort of argument often proposed in incidents of that sort?
Yeah, it's a problematic argument. Yeah, it's true. Had he stayed in the car, he probably wouldn't have been shot. I think the more morally urgent argument, though, is, you know, if the officer hadn't shot him in the back, he wouldn't have been shot. You know, I mean, that's, you know, the officer had a choice. The officer didn't have to shoot him in the back. He was running away. He didn't have a weapon. He planted the weapon. So if there's a moral corrective here, I don't think it's at the part of Walter Scott. I think. But it speaks to a bigger question of, do you have to be perfect to survive state violence, right? I mean, yeah, Mike Brown could have made different choices in the Ferguson market. He shouldn't have stolen a cigarillo.
But he wasn't arrested for stealing the cigars.
He was stopped for jaywalking. But even if he'd been stopped for stealing the cigarillo, which he wasn't, you're absolutely right. It's not a capital crime in America, right? You don't get the electric chair. You don't get the lethal injection for stealing a cigar. You get a slap on the wrist. They may just say, get a cigar back. So if that's the case, then that can't be how these things happen. And part of broken windows policing is that we begin looking for all the ticky-tack offenses so that an Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge gets stopped for selling CDs. It's 2016. If you're selling CDs in 2016, you're not really a threat to anybody, including the economy, right? It's like Apple's not shaking in its boots because you're selling a CD which has been made in 15 years, you know? There's a way that we are policing minor crimes. Eric Garner selling Lucy cigarettes, you know? We're policing these minor crimes, and the result oftentimes is heightened levels of violence because they're largely avoidable incidents.
What's post-intentional racism?
Post-intentional racism is a term created by the brilliant Imani Perry, professor at Princeton University. And I think too often we look for racism as the kind of angry, rabid, foaming at the mouth kind of sexy racism that looks good on cable news, right? You know, the person says, I hate all black people, and shoots them, or you find a swastika tattooed on his back after he kills some poor woman. But I think we have to look beyond the level of intention, though. I meant to do that Pee Wee Herman kind of racism, right? And I think we have to say, wait a minute, maybe there's a more nuanced understanding of what racism could be, one that is about culture, one that is about the kind of psychological dimensions of racism. Things that may not be resolvable at the level of intention. I'll give you a quick example. George Zimmerman, I doubt, woke up one morning and said, I'm going to go kill Trayvon. I don't think he said that. Do I think George Zimmerman may have been racist? Yeah, I think he is racist, just based on things that he said and done. But I think when he saw Trayvon, he legitimately saw somebody who was violent. He was wrong. Trayvon wasn't violent.
He was just walking down the
street. He was armed with Skittles and a hoodie. And Arizona iced tea, right? I mean, he was a kid watching the All-Star game like the rest of us, right? But my point is that George Zimmerman didn't have to have the racist intent of a good old boy in 1940 who said, I'm going to just go shoot a Negro. No, he really saw violence. So then he shoots him. He kills him. He goes to court. And then there's a jury of his peers. The jury of his peers, to a large extent, are asked to invoke what we call a reasonable man standard, right? They're supposed to ask, what would a reasonable person do under the same circumstances? Now, the juror has to look at Trayvon and decide whether they would have done the same thing in that dark night. And they're looking at Trayvon and they're saying, or the pictures of Trayvon, and they're saying, yeah, I would have killed him too. So legally, George Zimmerman is not guilty. Honestly, the jurors are doing what they're supposed to do. But the problem is, the reason why they would reasonably, quote unquote, do the same thing is because they are also informed by these deeply embedded white supremacist narratives of who and what black bodies are in public. So lots of people are scared of black people in public at night, even if they're not armed. So what happens is, the law then has codified an irrational fear of black bodies. So that's post-intentional, right? The juror is just trying to do the right thing. They're just being honest. George Zimmerman was just playing on his fear. The problem is the fears are irrational, but they're codified in law. That's part of what post-intentional racism is.
But another man who killed a young black man, Jordan Davis,
yes,
has been found guilty and sent to jail.
Second time, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, as they say, you can strike a straight lick with a crooked stick, as my grandmama used to say. You know, sometimes you get it right, you know, even if the system is broken. But one, we have to have a more expansive conception of justice, right? I mean, I hope a just world isn't where people go to jail for shooting black people. I hope the just world is where people stop shooting black people based on irrational and racist fear. And I'm not sure how afraid Jordan Davis's killer was. They went back home and ordered room service. He went back home and had a drink, went to bed, and woke up the next day. I mean, they didn't have the kind of, they weren't shaking in their boots. They weren't traumatized, you know, like Darren Wilson.
He was just angered that these kids were playing their radio loud.
And that's exactly right. It sounded like ego, but again, stand your ground allows ordinary citizens to be militarized. So at the same time that we have the police and law enforcement militarized, stand your ground and expansive gun laws allow everyday citizens to be militarized against the vulnerable. But if we're honest about it, that weaponizing, or rather arming of everyday citizens isn't universal. I mean, can you imagine if Trayvon had shot George Zimmerman? Because this crazy guy had been following me around the Sanford Estates, and he kept asking me where I was going, and he wouldn't leave me alone. And then he pushed me, and so I shot him, and I stood my ground. I mean, can you imagine? Trayvon would be in jail right now.
My guess is Mark Lamont Hill, who's written Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It's published by Atria Books. This is WMIC. WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some of our listeners may remember an incident that occurred before Ferguson and before Black Lives Matter, involving Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Sergeant James Crowley, that ultimately led to the Beer Summit. Mm-hmm. How do you think President Obama handled that incident?
Depends on what part, you know. I think when he said the police behaved stupidly, it was a rare moment of racial candor from the president. I was excited to hear him say that. Then people responded, and people were frustrated, and people were upset. And then he had to have some trouser hitching and good old boy laughing at the White House over beer. And I was like, okay, we've trivialized something. That's actually interesting and nuanced. But it's also interesting that the president came to the defense of Henry Louis Gates, who's a friend of mine and someone who I respect and admire a great deal. But it was almost as if we were saying that this shouldn't happen to Skip. As if it's like when the kids get killed
because he's one of us instead of one of them.
He's one of us, right? He's one of us who got confused for one of them. Mm-hmm. It's like when Sandy Hook Elementary gets shot up, an awful tragedy, right? I mean, my heart just weeps when those poor children were shot. But you watch some news reports and say, "Oh my God, this shouldn't happen here," as if it should happen somewhere else.
Well, we have had a similar situation just recently where a kid was sitting on his porch waiting for his mother to come home, and somebody called the cops and said, I think there might be a break-in, even though he's just sitting on the porch. And the cops came. He showed his ID to prove that he lived there. He tried to call his mother. They knocked the phone out of his hand and beat him up and handcuffed him. Now the cop is suspended for this because it just happened to have been filmed.
Right. The advent of the cell phone camera in the last 20 years, and really the real significant use of it in the last 10, has changed the game. You see, in America, black witness has never meant much. Black folks saying something happened hasn't meant much. There's never been a shortage of black people who have told us that we get shot, that we're getting beaten or harassed. There's never been a shortage of trans women who say, hey, we're being criminalized and overly surveilled in public space. Never been a shortage of that. It just hasn't meant anything to anybody. The camera forces America to come to terms with what it has stubbornly resisted. And suddenly, these cases come out more and more. The police haven't gotten more violent. They haven't gotten more indifferent to social misery. There, you know, it's that we can see it now. And even when we see it, it's still like, hey, don't believe your lying eyes. Believe what we're telling you. It's like Rodney King all over again.
You write about Sandra Bland and her encounter with the Texas State Trooper named Brian Encinia, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Which led ultimately to her death by suicide. How does her death link to the actions of the state in that case?
Let's assume the most generous interpretation, which is that the state didn't kill her directly, right? That she committed suicide, because there were debates about that, right? Let's assume that this wasn't a cover-up by the... When I say generous, I mean assuming that there wasn't a cover-up and a killing by the state. I actually don't believe that. I believe Sandra Bland committed suicide. I do believe that. I don't believe there was a cover-up or a conspiracy at that level. But from the moment of the interaction, Sandra Bland was treated differently than she should have been.
The cop said he was going to light her up.
Yeah, I mean, the language... Even the police have disciplined him for this. I mean, there's no doubt about that. She was stopped for the taillight, which apparently, or the illegal lane change. I think that we should commission a study of black people and their inability to signal lane changes. Because black people get pulled over for lane changes more than any group of people I've ever seen. It's like it's the perfect pretext stop, right? And we have to begin there. Because if I followed you driving, and I'm assuming you look like you're a good driver. You look wise and smart and careful. But if I followed you for 15 minutes, I could find a reason to pull you over. You're not always going to be four car lengths away. You're not always going to be the perfect speed. I suspect when it says 45, you may go 47. You know, there might be a reason to pull you over. We just don't, right? That's the point of heavy policing. But then when they pull her over, she's like, give me the ticket. She's like, fine, give me a ticket. And she asked why she was pulled over, which is her right. He didn't like her attitude, but you can't arrest somebody because you don't like their attitude. He didn't just want compliance. He wanted deference. He wanted her to like kowtow to him, and she didn't want to do that. This is a common occurrence with women, with police officers, but especially black women and girls, when they don't conform to what they expect standards, patriarchal standards of femininity are, they get in trouble. But then he pulls her out of the car because she doesn't want to put out a cigarette, which she doesn't legally have to. She ends up in jail. They ask her if she's attempted suicide. She says yes. They ask her if she's ever been depressed. She says yes. They ask her if she's taking any drugs. She says, I'm taking Keppra for my epilepsy. Guess what? That causes suicidal thoughts. He says, good. And instead of putting her on suicide watch, which would demand a 15-minute, every 15-minute kind of patrol of the correctional officer, they subject her to the standard procedure, which is 1 hour, to watch her, to come check on her every hour instead of every 15 minutes. But they don't actually come every hour. They come closer to every 2 hours. So they created this space. They put her in there wrongfully, and then they ignored mental health issues, and then they put her in a space of trauma. And most people who commit suicide in jail commit it within the first 3 or 4 days, especially women. And then here's the last piece of this. This is really important. Yes, Sandra Bland would probably not be in jail, would not have died, rather, if she were a man. Yes, Sandra Bland would I would say very likely would not have been put in jail and ultimately wouldn't have died if she were white. But if Sandra Bland had the $5,000 bail or the $500 bond, $500, she wouldn't have stayed in jail and she probably wouldn't have died. The fact that not having $500 means that you stay in jail and $500 means that you die. The fact that you have to trade money for freedom to me is an act of civic evil. And right now, 84% of people in jails around this country, 84% are there because they don't have the money to pay the bail to get out. That is evil.
In July 2015, the month that she killed herself, 5 other black women died in police custody.
Yes.
Is that statistic unusual? Was it just a bad month?
It was a unusually bad month. But black women dying in custody is not uncommon. Largely, again, issues of suicide, issues of... 2 were suicides in this case, I believe. Others were... women reporting that they had health concerns and them being ignored. And these types of this ignoring of health concerns is not uncommon, but it's especially common for black women, partly because they just don't care and partly because black women are expected to shoulder a greater amount of stress and pain. And then there's less redress for prisoners. The Prison Litigation Reform Act which was came in under the Clinton administration, Clinton, was made it much more. It basically closed the courthouse doors to prisoners, so it's harder to get redress when something does happen.
Now, we don't have any more time left, and there are a lot of more stories that you tell in this book. But in the end, you get the feeling that there's no solution.
Oh, there's solution, you know. There's solution. At the beginning of the book, I talk about how America, how the nobodiness is undergirded, not just by race, class, gender, stuff like that, but also by a nation state that defends class at all costs. We have to reimagine how we understand class. We have to reimagine how we engage white supremacy, and we have to organize. The book ends with a chapter called Somebody, which is all about the people who have created movements in the last 2 years and longer to help imagine a new world. We can imagine a world without prisons, prison abolition. We can imagine a world without police. We can demilitarize and disarm police. We can imagine a world where everyone has access to this American dream. We can do this. We can win. I've never been more confident that nobody will always be able to assert their somebody-ness so that we can all create a world that is more fair, more just, and more peaceful than ever before.
Mark Lamont Hill is currently the host of BET News and VH1 Live, as well as a political contributor for CNN. He is professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College, and his latest book, with a foreword by Todd Brewster, is Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It's published by Atria. And thank you so much for stopping by, despite the fact that you are fighting a terrible cold.
Oh, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure. We got to do this again.